This is Bradcast producer Desi Doyen. We're off today. Today's Bradcast was originally recorded on October 1st, 2025.
If there is a shutdown, I think it would be a tremendously negative mark on the President of the United States. He's the one that has to get people together.
Well, I agree with you, Donald Trump from 2011, when you had a whole lot less dementia.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling something right.
No, no.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair, and I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yes, I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. And on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the public airwaves and the internets around the country and the world. Blanketing planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow. Says me from bradblog.com. Thanks for joining us for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast. Just as we suggested on yesterday's program, the federal government did, in fact, end up shutting down just after midnight at 12:01 a.m. on Wednesday, or at least what they call a partial shutdown, where the president gets to decide which agencies will or won't stay open for supposed national security or economic reasons, etc., after Republicans refused to negotiate with Democrats on a budget bill to keep the government open. Democrats are seeking to block Republicans from raising health care costs for millions of Americans at year's end. For his part, Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson is not even pretending to try to negotiate. He sent his members home last week and told them they did not need to bother to return to D.C. until October 7, the earliest. In the meantime, Democrats are in Washington trying to work out a deal that Republicans and Donald Trump clearly do not want, because they apparently seem to believe that despite controlling the White House and both chambers of Congress with the ability to keep the government open by themselves without any help of the Democrats, if they really, really wanted to, that they seem to think that Americans are going to blame Democrats for fighting to prevent Republicans from spiking their health care costs beginning on January 1. We'll see who's right. But for the moment, Democrats seem to be standing strong against any bill that would allow Affordable Care Act premiums to spike for some 25 million Americans as of January 1, along with huge, nearly $1 trillion in cuts to Medicaid, potentially $500 billion in cuts to Medicare, and unless they can ensure that any help they give to Republicans to pass such a spending bill with 60 votes needed in the Senate would not then simply be ignored by Republicans thereafter with a simple majority vote, killing the spending that they previously agreed to. As we have seen Republicans do in other spending matters that were previously adopted along with Democrats during the appropriations process since this Donald Trump's new term has begun. Now, the last government shutdown also occurred the last time that Republicans controlled all three, all branches of power in D.C. when Trump was also president at the time. That was the longest shutdown in the history of the nation, at 35 days, when Trump insisted that Congress give him billions of dollars to build his border wall. Eventually, he caved, the government reopened, and then Trump went on to steal the money anyway for the wall from the U.S. military, for the wall that Mexico did not pay for. How long will it go on this time? Well, nobody knows. And Republicans are making threats of massive layoffs of federal workers, though they clearly did not need a shutdown to do that. They've been doing that all along.
I know. It's like, why is that a threat? You're already doing it, so what's the difference?
Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi.
They have been doing it often illegally all year long, and so a shutdown gives them no extra legal power to do so, no matter what they're going to tell you. So, for now, Democrats seem to be holding fast to their refusals to let Republicans raise health care costs for Americans, and Republicans aren't even trying in return. This could go on for a while, even as government services shut down. Tens of thousands of federal workers are forced to work without pay, and the Trump administration is violating the law by putting notices onto federal websites. Like the Department of Housing and Urban Development, which reads this morning, quote, "The radical left in Congress shut down the government. HUD will use available resources to help Americans in need." That is totally unlawful. It's a complete and clear violation of the Hatch Act, which bars the use of nonpartisan government agencies from using their resources for partisan politicking. But clearly the rule of law no longer matters in the federal government, at least regarding Republicans. Speaking of which, we have a number of election-related stories along similar lines today, with Republicans abusing their office for partisan purposes.
What a shock.
I know, it's shocking. We have this in a number of cases today, and we will be joined by the great Ari Berman momentarily to discuss a few of them, including the Trump administration's effort to force states to hand over state voter registration data to the federal government for what seems to be nefarious partisan purposes. But let's start here. Nevada's top federal prosecutor has asked the FBI to investigate debunked Republican claims about voter fraud in the 2020 election. Yes, that old chestnut, the one that Trump lost that election in 2020 in Nevada, as part of a probe that she hopes will influence congressional races and ensnare Democrats, according to a government document seen exclusively by Reuters this week. In late July, U.S. Attorney Sigal Chhota told Justice Department officials that she met with federal agents and handed them a thumb drive containing data compiled by Nevada's Republican Party about people living in the U.S. illegally who cast ballots in the 2020 election and members of Indian tribes who allegedly received cash for ballots, according to the document. She also urged the agents to call the state's Republican Party attorney. Chhota said she expects to pursue a variety of investigative lines of inquiry, but legal experts said she has multiple conflicts of interest and should recuse herself from any investigations on this matter involving certain legal clients of her own or political matters that she was previously involved with directly. Justice Department guidelines also stipulate that prosecutors cannot initiate a case based on, quote, political association, activities, or beliefs, and yet that does seem to be what she is doing. Chhota told senior department officials that she wants to remove, quote, illegal aliens from voter rolls. Okay. I suppose in and of itself, if there are in fact any non-citizens on the voter rolls. But Chhota added a twist. She wants to remove those registered voters, whether they exist or otherwise, because, as her memo makes clear, she believed it would possibly lead to a, quote, reallocation of census numbers, and therefore affect the race for Nevada's 4th congressional district seat, currently held by Democratic U.S. Rep. Stephen Horsford. In other words, apparently she thinks that there are enough non-citizen voters that are on the rolls unlawfully that nobody noticed before, tens of thousands presumably, that removing them from the rolls would necessarily change the way congressional districts needed to be drawn in Nevada in order to keep districts roughly the same size. So, you know, remove a bunch of people from the rolls. Oh, look, there's not enough people in this district. Let's move some more Republicans into it, essentially. That seems to be what she is calling for. But that is not all she is calling for, not by a long shot, according to Reuters. Chhota said she also wants to exonerate the 6 Republicans who were prosecuted by Nevada Attorney General Aaron Ford for posing as fake electors in the failed bid to steal the state from Joe Biden back in 2020 and the nationwide scheme to steal enough votes from Joe Biden to keep then-President Donald Trump in power even after he lost that election. Chadha, as it turns out, before being tapped as Nevada's interim U.S. attorney by Donald Trump, well, she just happened to be an attorney who was defending one of the accused in question, one of the fake electors. A lower court in that particular matter has dismissed the charges against these fake GOP electors, though the state appealed the case, and that is still pending. Either way, as the attorney for one of the accused, she should have nothing to do with the government efforts to exonerate her own client.
Yeah, that's kind of a raging conflict of interest.
I mean, I ain't an attorney, but I seem to understand that much. Chadha told senior officials that she hopes to demonstrate an ongoing conspiracy between the White House, the Biden White House, and state attorneys general. According to the document, has she found evidence for such an ongoing conspiracy? Or does she just want to go on a partisan witch hunt for such evidence, which would be improper as a federal prosecutor? She also called for takedowns of unions and nonprofits that operate voter registration drives and a probe into the financing of these, quote, illegal acts by the Democratic Political Action Committee, Act Blue, she added. So what are those illegal acts? Well, it's unclear, but Act Blue raises money for Democratic candidates for political office. So, you know, that sounds pretty illegal to me, doesn't it? At least in the Trump era, raising money for Democrats? Are you? Anyway, Chadha's investigation or her attempted investigation or her attempted witch hunt, whatever you prefer, is the latest in a string of high-profile criminal cases initiated under Attorney General Pam Bondi targeting Trump's political foes. Trump has urged Republican-led states to redraw their House of Representatives districts to protect their majority, if possible, in next year's midterms. And, of course, his U.S. attorney in Nevada, well, she's just doing her part to weaponize the federal prosecutor's office to further Donald Trump and the Republicans' political agenda. All of this being of a piece, I believe, with what we will speak to Ari Berman about momentarily, as the DOJ itself is targeting mostly Democratic-controlled states regarding their voter database files. But we'll get to that shortly. Legal experts say Chadha's actions potentially violate federal government ethics rules because of her prior work as an attorney representing certain Republican clients. Not just the fake elector, but as Nevada's Republican National Committee chairwoman, who also ran unsuccessfully in 2022 for state attorney general. Until April of this year, Chadha served as a defense attorney to one of those fake electors and represented the RNC and the Nevada Republican Party in a lawsuit alleging that Nevada failed to maintain clean voter rolls, according to court records. Richard Painter, who served as the White House chief ethics officer during Republican George W. Bush's presidency, said, quote, "The ethics rule is pretty clear that when she's in the United States Attorney's Office, she has to recuse from any particular party matter in which she represented a client or otherwise participated personally and substantially in the private sector." Reuters could not determine if the FBI had, in fact, opened an election fraud probe based on Chadha's request or otherwise, but Chadha told a local news station less than 2 weeks later that such a probe was underway. So talk about a dirty cop. There you go. But beyond her partisan weaponization of her own office to help her own party electorally, there's another problem. She, Chadha, should not even be in the office at all. Chadha, first appointed as an interim U.S. attorney in late March, is facing a legal challenge by federal public defenders who accuse the DOJ of pursuing illegal personnel maneuvers in order to keep Chadha in power as acting U.S. attorney beyond her temporary appointment, which expired in July. Reuters exclusive on Chadha's efforts to game battleground state Nevada's elections and punish Trump's political foes was published just before a federal judge this week ruled in that particular case. On Tuesday night, after we got off the air, a federal judge disqualified Nevada's acting U.S. attorney, Sigal Chadha, from several cases after concluding Tuesday that the Trump appointee was, yes, serving illegally, that she has stayed in the temporary job as acting director, acting U.S. attorney, longer than is allowed by law. If laws still matter in this country, U.S. District Judge David Campbell, a George W. Bush appointee, disqualified Chadha from supervising the criminal prosecutions in question, siding with defense lawyers who argued that her authority had expired in July. Judge Campbell ordered government attorneys on the case to tell the court within 7 days that Chadha is not directing their work. He did not dismiss the indictments, however. So we'll see how this plays out. But this was the second time in recent weeks that the Trump administration's effort to extend the appointments of handpicked acting U.S. attorneys beyond the 120-day limit that is set by federal law has come back to bite them. A judge reached the very same conclusion as Judge Campbell in August in ruling that acting U.S. attorney in New Jersey, Alina Habba, another Trump defense lawyer, was, in fact, in the job illegally. Under federal law, if a permanent U.S. attorney is not nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate within 120 days, judges of the federal district court can then appoint an interim until that vacancy is filled. The judge in Chadha's case took aim at the Trump administration's strategy of using a string of temporary appointments to allow Trump's candidates to bypass the usual requirements that U.S. attorneys be confirmed by the Senate. For example, in Habba's case, after she was removed by the court, she was then named by Pam Bondi to be the deputy U.S. attorney general. And then Pam Bondi fired the U.S. attorney general who had moved into that slot only to make Habba then move from the second place job back into the first place job. That's the way they're gaming the system. The judge in Nevada pointed to the Federal Vacancies Reform Act of 1998, which Congress passed specifically to regulate the temporary filling of executive branch vacancies that require presidential appointments and Senate confirmations. Just another law that the Trump administration is trying to ignore or trying to violate and thinking they'll be able to get away with it. Her nomination, Chadha, drew opposition from Nevada, both of Nevada's Democratic U.S. senators. Both vowed to block her if the administration tried to make her appointment permanent, calling her an election denier who has advocated for political violence and supported illegal actions by Donald Trump. The appointment of Trump loyalists to the Department of Justice has also deepened concerns, according to AP, that the agency under Bondi is being weaponized in pursuit of investigations, you think? And now, in fact, prosecutions of people that the president regards as his political enemies, including former FBI Director James Comey, who just last Thursday was charged with lying to Congress in a criminal case filed days after Trump urged Bondi to prosecute him in what appears to have been meant as a private message that Trump published publicly on his failing social media site, that after three investigations by three different Trump-appointed prosecutors all failed to find evidence for bringing a case against Comey, including Trump's own U.S. attorney for the very busy and important Eastern District of Virginia, Eric Siebert, who resigned a little over a week ago rather than bring charges against Comey, only to be replaced by yet another of Trump's personal attorneys, an insurance attorney who has never prosecuted a case in her life. who was apparently all too happy to bring two ridiculous charges against Comey. Actually, she tried to bring three. The grand jury rejected one of them, but she was willing to bring these charges against Comey just 3 days after being put in place as the interim U.S. attorney. And one more story about elections and voter suppression and accountability before we get to Ari. This is one that broke on Friday night last week, but we've been trying to get to it all week. MyPillow founder, our good friend Mike Lindell, defamed the election technology company named Smartmatic with false statements that its voting machines helped to rig the 2020 presidential election. That, according to a federal judge in Minnesota on Friday. But the judge in this case, U.S. District Judge Jeffrey Bryan, a Joe Biden appointee, deferred until future proceedings the question of whether or not Lindell, one of the country's most prominent propagators of false claims that the 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump, whether or not he acted with, quote, actual malice, which Smartmatic will still need to prove in order to collect any damages in this case. The judge said there are, quote, genuine fact disputes as to whether Lindell's statements were made, quote, with full knowledge that they were false or made with reckless disregard to their falsity, unquote, as the law requires. The judge noted that the defense says that Lindell has, quote, an unwavering belief that his statements were truthful. So the judge concurs they were false statements, but was and is dumb Mike Lindell smart enough to know otherwise? We told you in recent months this was going to be Mike Lindell's defense in this case. His attorneys even admitted that, yeah, Lindell was wrong, but claimed it wasn't defamation because Lindell was actually so dumb that he actually believed what he was saying.
Oh, my.
The statements cited by the judge arose from Lindell's criticism of the results of the 2020 election right here in California's Los Angeles County, which Democratic candidate Joe Biden carried with 71% of the vote over Trump at the time. The county used Smartmatic's computerized touchscreen ballot marking device systems. It was the company's only customer in the U.S. for the 2020 election. And Lindell alleges that the machines were rigged to change Trump votes to Biden votes and that Trump actually won here in Los Angeles in 2020. Really, Mike? The judge ruled that there were 51 specific times when Lindell falsely claimed in documentaries that he produced or through various media and personal appearances, 51 specific times he claimed that Smartmatic interfered with the results, despite no evidence to support that claim. But Smartmatic's attorney, Eric Connolly, said the company will be seeking nine-figure damages from Lindell and from MyPillow for, quote, spreading lies about the company. Smartmatic, a company that does have some problems, even if none of them appear to have anything to do with rigging the 2020 election in the U.S., Smartmatic has been on a winning streak lately, having reached multi-million-dollar settlements last year with two right-wing news outlets, Newsmax and One American News, OAN. And the company still has an active case against Fox News, which previously settled for more than $750 million, $787.5 million to be exact, with the voting machine company Dominion Voting Systems, which was also defamed by the right in these right-wing media outlets after the 2020 election. Lindell also has made similar claims against Dominion. He has already lost a case involving the company in June when a jury ruled that he defamed a former Dominion employee by accusing him of treason. The jury awarded $2.3 million in damages in that case, so we will see what happens here. By the way, the dumb MyPillow dude, Mike Lindell, also said that he recently reestablished residence in his original home state of Minnesota. after he had been living until recently in Texas. Why did he do that in Minnesota? Well, a step toward a likely run for governor. Why are you laughing? A run for governor against the incumbent Democratic governor, Tim Walz, next year. Oh, where can I donate?
Get your popcorn.
Let's get him on that Republican ticket for governor in Minnesota next year, shall we? Mike Lindell, 2026. All right, let's take a quick break here. We will be back with Ari Berman on just what exactly the Trump administration's DOJ is doing in their attempts to force states, certain states, to turn over their voter databases. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to The Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad here at The Bradcast and bradblog.com. We fight for election integrity all year around, like no other media outlet in the nation. But of course, we need your help to help us remain on your public airwaves and completely independent. Please help us continue that fight over your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
You're listening to an encore presentation of The Bradcast.
Now they're planning the crime of the century. Well, what will it be?
Who knows? So many crimes, so little time. Welcome back to The Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Ari Berman over at Mother Jones reports that as the Trump administration vows to undertake a sweeping crackdown on liberal organizations following the murder of MAGA influencer Charlie Kirk, the Justice Department last month sued two blue states, Maine and Oregon, to attempt to gain access to their full, unredacted voter registration lists, intensifying President Trump's anti-voting efforts. Last week, as Berman reports in a follow-up over the weekend, the DOJ's Civil Rights Division sued an additional six states, including California, Michigan, Minnesota, New York, New Hampshire, and Pennsylvania, for that same information as well. The DOJ has demanded state voter registration databases, which include sensitive personal information like driver's license and social security numbers, from at least 27 states at this point. As Berman notes, the department has never done this before. In the bargain, they have been rebuffed by red and blue states alike, he reports, who are reluctant to share this information with the Trump administration for some odd reason. But then the DOJ singled out Maine and Oregon initially with legal action, claiming the states both violated the National Voter Registration Act, the Help America Vote Act, or HAVA, and the Civil Rights Act of 1960. How did they do so, according to the Trump administration? We will try to find that out in a moment. Both states are now vowing to fight back. Quote, it is absurd that the Department of Justice is targeting our state when Republican and Democratic secretaries all across the country are fighting back against this federal abuse of power just like we are, said Maine's Secretary of State Shenna Bellows, a Democrat. Oregon Secretary of State Tobias Reed, who is also a Democrat, said, quote, if the president wants to use the DOJ to go after his political opponents and undermine our elections, I look forward to seeing them in court. The other six states that have since been threatened or sued by the Department of Justice are fighting back as well. Al Schmidt, Pennsylvania's Republican Secretary of State, called the DOJ's demand, quote, unprecedented and unlawful, adding that the state, quote, will vigorously fight the federal government's overreach in court. California Secretary of State Dr. Shirley Weber, a Democrat, called the DOJ lawsuit a fishing expedition and pretext for partisan policy objectives. So what are those partisan policy objectives exactly in seeking this information? Why is the administration seeking access to these databases in the first place? What are they accusing the states of having done in their claims that they have violated three of the nation's landmark voting rights-related acts? And by the way, Didn't the Trump administration already try and fail to do the very same thing during Trump's first term when our delusional president was trying to make the case that he actually won the popular vote in 2016, but for some 3 million unlawful voters here in the very blue state of California? 3 million unlawful voters that nobody else seems to have noticed or have evidence for? Well, there's no one better to answer these questions and more, I think, than our old friend Ari Berman, national voting rights correspondent at the great Mother Jones magazine. He is the author of the 2015 New York Times bestseller Give Us the Ballot. And his latest in 2024 is Minority Rule, the Right-Wing Attack on the Will of the People and the Fight to Resist It. Naturally, Ari Berman has been all over this story from the jump as perhaps the nation's leading voting rights journalist. It has been too many years, my friend, but welcome back to the broadcast, Ari.
It has been. Great to talk to you again, Brad. Thank you.
So before we get to the response from the states and the response in kind from the Trump administration to those states, you mentioned that DOJ is claiming that, first, Maine and Oregon somehow violated the National Voter Registration Act, the Help America Vote Act, the Civil Rights Act, and that access to their voter database will somehow, I guess, help prove that case. Do you have any idea what they're actually claiming that these states have done to violate those laws?
No, I mean, I've read the lawsuits and it basically seems like DOJ is suing them because they're not complying with what DOJ wants. Basically, they wanted the voter files. States wouldn't provide them because they initially sent letters to the states. Mm-hmm. And now they're basically saying, well, you didn't provide them, so now we're suing you. It's basically, it's kind of like the same thing that always happens with the Trump administration. If you don't do what we want, okay, we will retaliate against you. And this is really interesting because one of the last things you said in your intro, I think, is the most important thing, which is the Trump administration tried to get this before when they formed this Pence-Kobach, quote-unquote, Election Integrity Commission after the 2016 election.
Right.
And they were not just rebuffed by the states. They were emphatically rebuffed by the states. The Mississippi Secretary of State famously told Kris Kobach to go jump in the Gulf of Mexico back when we called it that.
Right.
And this is happening more under the radar. It's not getting as much attention. And I think it's because it's now happening under the imprimatur of the Justice Department, which is doing so many scandalous things it's hard to keep track of.
Yeah.
But also it's more serious because the Trump Election Integrity Commission, quote unquote, tried to get it. They couldn't, and they couldn't do anything about it. Mm. Well, the Department of Justice can sue, and they're not just suing, but you could see other elements of the Trump administration get involved, for example, to say we're going to withhold federal funding if you don't provide this data. We could not just go after the states, but we could prosecute election officials. We could do other things to try to put pressure on you. But it seems to me that they want this data so they can then hand it over to the Department of Homeland Security to run through all these databases that are not designed for the purpose of doing this, but to basically say, we found illegal voting. President Trump was right. There is illegal voting. We found it. Therefore, our elections are corrupted, and we have to do X, Y, and Z in response to that, those corrupt elections that President Trump was right about all along. And I think that is the real purpose why they're requesting this.
Yeah, and I want to drill down into that a little bit further. But for the moment, just sticking with the initial threat, you mentioned the Election Integrity Commission, so-called, from his first term. At least there, they asked all 50 states to provide data, to sort of give some, you know, patina of a nonpartisan investigation or something. This time, it's the DOJ, as you say. They're only asking 27 states for that information. Why only 27 this time? And do these happen to be mostly states controlled by Democrats by any chance?
Well, I think that they're going to get around to asking all 50 for it. That's what they say. Uh-huh. I mean, there's so many people have left the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice because they've been forced out that I think they may just not have the manpower to do this at the moment. But my impression is that they're going to ask all 50 states to do so. But if you look at who they have sued, it's almost overwhelmingly been Democratic states or Democratic secretaries of state. They did sue Pennsylvania, which has a Republican secretary of state, but it has a Democratic governor. So, and the Republican they sued was someone who very famously stood up to Trump in 2020, Al Schmidt, who was head of the Elections Commission in Philly and now is the Secretary of State there. So basically, the only state that I believe that they have sued that has a Republican governor is New Hampshire. So otherwise, they seem to be suing states that either have Democratic governors or Democratic secretaries of state or some combination of both, which seems to be that shows to me that this is partly about trying to get the data, but it's also about politics in terms of who they're targeting.
And New Hampshire, of course, being a notoriously evenly divided state with some very, very close races there. You report, Ari, that 11 states have turned over at least some data to the DOJ, but they withheld some of the more private data when they turned it over, like Social Security numbers, et cetera, when doing so?
Yeah, the 11 states, according to the Brennan Center for Justice, provided what was publicly available. They're publicly available voter files. So I guess that's something that anyone could get access to, as opposed to the sensitive information. If anyone could get access to it, I don't know why the Department of Justice would have to send letters or sue to get it. There has been a lack of transparency throughout this entire process, though, in terms of why the DOJ wants this information. They have never come out and said in a straightforward way, we need this information to do so. No other administration has needed this information on voters to be able to enforce any of the civil rights laws that the administration claims to be interested in enforcing. Leave aside the fact that they're probably not actually that interested in enforcing the Civil Rights Act of 1960 or the Help America Vote Act or the National Voter Registration Act or, of course, the Voting Rights Act.
They like the National Voter Registration Act because that allows them, they think, to cull voter registration lists every few years. And whenever Republicans do it, they seem to overcull and they remove perfectly legitimate voters from the rolls. But at least that law, they seem to actually give a damn about for that reason, it seems to me.
Yeah, they like the one part of the National Voter Registration Act that requires list maintenance. But they don't like all the other parts of it that were set up to make it easier to register to vote. They don't seem that interested in that part of it. But yeah, I mean, there's been a lack of transparency all along of why they're requesting this data, how states are responding to it, and what states are turning over. There are some states that are working more closely with the Justice Department on some of these requests and working more closely on with the Department of Homeland Security on doing these citizenship checks on voters. Louisiana, Texas, there's a few other red states that have Indiana, I think, provided their voter file. So there's some states that have worked more closely, but in general, there has been more pushback from the states on this than other parts of the Trump agenda.
And is that what you think they are after here? Somehow they get these databases and somehow they can use these databases to go through them and prove that they are filled with non-citizen voters?
Yes. And I don't want to get too technical here, but what they're trying to do is they're trying to run it through the SAVE database that's run by the Department of Homeland Security. And the way that that database works is it tracks your Social Security number. So what it does is when someone has an interaction, let's say you have a Social Security number and you're a green card holder, for example, you're end up in that database, but it doesn't track if your citizenship status changes.
Right.
If you become a naturalized American, you have a green card and you become a naturalized American, which a lot of people do, it does not update in that database. Therefore, if the DOJ runs this list of voters through a database that's not designed to search in the most up-to-date way, people's naturalization status, they are going to get lists that say there are a lot of non-citizens on the rolls because that database is not designed for that purpose and is not updated to track naturalized citizens.
And yet they feel that if they have the actual state database, if they actually get the Social Security numbers or driver's license from that database from each state, then they can run it against the SAVE database and reveal all of these non-citizen voters, many of whom may actually now be citizens after all.
Exactly. And I think that's exactly the point, is that they know it's not designed for this purpose, but they want it specifically so they can then spread propaganda to try to validate Trump's big lie, which has all sorts of advantages for them because there's lots of other things that the Trump administration and the Department of Justice want to do, like make it easier to purge voter rolls, go after election officials, implement policies that would make it harder to register to vote, like proof of citizenship to register to vote. And any time they can try to validate the lies about voter fraud, it makes it easier for them to do all of those other things that are on President Trump's agenda, especially as we head into the midterm. So I think this is a very nefarious thing the Department of Justice is doing. I'm worried about both the practical and the propaganda effects of them doing this. And this has never been done under the imprimatur of the Department of Justice, which has the power to prosecute and to really go after people in a criminal way. And that puts a very dangerous element into our voting system that heretofore was not at play.
You quote our friend Justin Levitt, the election law expert, former deputy assistant AG in the DOJ Civil Rights Division under Obama, sort of conjecturing that any number of non-citizens they happen to find on the rolls, if they find any, that the administration is essentially going to lie about those numbers because there's often, you know, just a handful of a dozen or so that are discovered on the rolls. We know this thanks to past efforts by states to cull their own databases or even state and local prosecutors or even citizen investigators looking at these lists. They always find at least some number of non-citizens on lists who become signed up to vote and added to the registration database when they're, for example, at a government office like the DMV and they're handed a form, not realizing that they're not eligible to vote, but they fill out the form. And in most of those cases, those folks never go on to vote, even if they are somehow registered on the list. I mean, haven't we gone through this? Haven't we looked through these lists in various ways over the years and found that to be the case? Oh, there's a few non-citizens there. Almost none of them actually voted.
Yeah, I mean, the evidence of non-citizen voting is extremely, extremely rare. Occasionally are cases of, as you mentioned, non-citizens who accidentally get registered to vote. But the cases of non-citizens voting are so rare.
Right.
They're almost, if it ever ends up happening, it's almost always by mistake. It makes no logical sense that someone would risk their legal status right. or if they don't have legal status, risk deportation to cast a ballot. No one's ever showed why the risk reward there would go towards voting compared to people that are here to work and provide a better life for their family. The problem is both that the DOJ could manufacture a much larger number than reality says, but also there's going to be no transparency in terms of how they run this data. So we have no idea. We're not going to go to fact check whatever they say. It's not like they're going to hand over the voter files and the saved database and say, this is how we did everything. We're going to have to take Pam Bondi's word for it. I mean, this is the other part. I think that's kind of what Justin was saying. Like, how can we trust whatever they say about the data, given what DOJ and other groups aligned with the Trump administration have already done?
Well, obviously we can't. But that said, I mean, sort of one of the upsides, as I was thinking about this, one of the upsides is to play devil's advocate here for a second. One of the upsides of this going through the DOJ, of them actually making a case out of it, will be that, well, you know, won't they have to show their work, their evidence, if they're going to make some extraordinary claim at that point? They can't, you know, for years, Republicans have saying, well, we believe that, you know, there's millions of illegal voters or whatever. Now, wouldn't they have to actually show their evidence to make these claims if they are actually going to bring a lawsuit based on them? Isn't that arguably a good thing, sort of the way the so-called Election Integrity Commission from Trump, you know, in his first term, kind of publicly and embarrassingly fell apart when their claims were actually looked at?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's true. I mean, we'll see whether they win these lawsuits, and then we'll also see what information they have to provide to be able to win them. I'm more worried about what would happen if they got this information.
Yeah.
and being able to fact check it there. But I mean, the problem is that they've been disproven over and over again. I mean, right. They literally set up a commission to find voter fraud and they disbanded it. No right. one else spent it. They disbanded it
right.
without finding any evidence of fraud. And then the big lie just grew from there. So it doesn't seem like any kind of, even their own failure doesn't seem to convince anyone that this exists. But I think that the federal government is interested in trying to validate, to whatever extent they can, Trump's lies about voting mm-hmm. in a way that's never been done before. And this is being done on so many different levels now, from the DOJ to DHS to U.S. attorneys. And again, they're not going to get very far in terms of the data, but they could get pretty far in terms of the propaganda. And that could have real impacts because, of course, the Justice Department is talking about criminally charging election officials. President Trump has talked about a special prosecutor to investigate the 2020 election. We've already seen retaliation against the president's political opponents. We've already seen military deployments in blue states and blue cities. And so all of this makes me nervous when you talk about lies about voting intersecting with a department that has criminal mechanisms that they could try to enforce on the voting process. That is a very dangerous combination in this.
Yeah, it certainly, absolutely is. And especially for some of these election officials, you know, if they are charged in some way, sort of the way James Comey was. But when you look at James Comey's case, you say, you know what, there's nothing here. This is likely going to get thrown out by a judge or rejected by a jury. You know, and maybe I'm just trying to find an upside here, but I feel like, yes, this will be terrible if you're one of those officials who are charged. On the other hand, I just think they're going to not come up with evidence, or their evidence is going to be one point that occurs to me. For example, some states or localities, if I'm not mistaken, actually allow non-citizens to vote in certain local elections. You know, I can see the Trump administration saying, aha, look at all these non-citizens we found. Well, those non-citizens are registered to vote because they're allowed to vote. They just haven't voted in any federal elections.
True.
I mean, would those be voters who might get caught in this trap, even though they may not have actually voted unlawfully ever?
Yeah, I mean, that's not a bad point. I mean, I think that they probably already could figure that out. I would imagine that. There's some kind of tabulation of that to try to separate the pool of people.
Mm-hmm.
Who, I'm assuming election officials know this, that the status of these people who are casting ballots. But yeah, I mean, I think that you have to look at this as part of the larger agenda of the Trump administration. If this was the only thing they were doing, you could say, yeah, the threat would be mitigated.
But, right.
You know, you add it to all the other things. Yeah. They are doing, from the gerrymandering to reinvestigating the 2020 election to issuing executive orders that would dramatically change how people would vote, to the military deployments that could be a pretext for election deployments. I mean, mm-hmm. there's so much stuff happening right now that is alarming from a voting rights context and from a democracy context, that this request for voter data is just one piece of how they're pouring fuel on the fire.
A potentially very important piece, of course. And you hint at something else. And I think you sort of referred to this here as we've been chatting, but, you know, as we saw after the 2020 election, when it came to voting system software that was unlawfully obtained by, you know, Team Trump MAGA folks in Georgia, in Michigan, in Colorado, Pennsylvania, and elsewhere, they got this, you know, ill-gotten software code, and they had no problem sharing that proprietary software code across the internet with, you know, fellow Team Trump travelers. Do you have fear that they will do the same thing here with the personal information that is obtained from these voter database files, social security numbers, et cetera, that will be shared outside of the confines of the DOJ?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, because they're already talking about sharing it within agencies, and it's not hard to imagine them sharing with it their outside allies in this whole election denier network that exists to try to enforce the president's agenda. They're also doing all sorts of things with voting machines that are really crazy. I mean, the Department of Justice is trying to access voting machine equipment in states like Missouri and Colorado. I mean, people are people are in jail right now for doing that kind of thing. And now the Department of Justice is trying to get the access to this for the exact purpose of trying to prove Trump's lies about 2020. The president's executive order also has language in there that basically says the current voting machines are not certified. Therefore, we need new ones that are not yet available. Therefore, they could then use that as a reason to challenge the validity of the 2020
Despite
election.
The fact that it's nonsense, that these
exactly.
claims
I mean,
are utter
and, you know, there are real critiques that you and others have made about the security of our election system. Mm-hmm. The Trump administration is not making those critiques, right?
Right.
They are lying about the election system, and they're singling out voting technology that I don't think they really understand to try to lay the groundwork for challenging the results. And I think Trump is absolutely focused on doing this. And I think when he said he was going to issue an executive order, it hasn't come yet, banning mail voting and outlawing voting machines, two things he does not have the power to do.
Right.
I think it's all aimed at trying to lay the groundwork to contest the results if Republicans indeed lose the House, despite all their efforts, including the mid-decade gerrymandering to prevent that from happening.
Yeah, you described this effort overall in your recent articles in pretty clear, stark terms. You describe it as the GOP's, quote, voter suppression agenda. Is that it? Is that all that this really amounts to? And as obnoxious and un-American and perhaps unlawful as it is, how does this effort actually ultimately end up potentially preventing people from voting as you see it?
Well, I mean, I think it's more than just a voter suppression agenda. I mean, I think it's a complete rollback of democracy agenda.
There's that.
I mean, it's a full authoritarian takeover agenda, and we're seeing more and more of it by the day. I mean, I think it, you know, I think it first off, it leads to Americans being removed from the rolls wrongly, not being able to register to vote in the usual ways they register. So it starts there, preventing registration. Mm-hmm. Then it goes to making it harder to cast a ballot, whether that's through making it more difficult to vote or causing intimidation at the polls in a ways that people may not vote. Like I said, that's why I'm worried about these military deployments and what they could do in an election contest. Are they going to put National Guard members of the military in Democratic cities? Are they going to put ICE in immigrant neighborhoods? That kind of thing. And then, of course, even if people register, cast a ballot, will their votes be challenged like they were in 2020? But now Trump's in charge. And I mean, he was in charge in 2020, but he was sort of on his way out. Now you would say, well, they're not going anywhere. So how will that look? And you have a Republican Party that has just doubled down on election denialism. I'm not going to say any of this is going to work necessarily.
Right.
But this is what I'm concerned about, is them sort of going after every step in the process in terms of preventing people from casting a ballot or having their ballot counted.
Yeah, and add to that what we're seeing this week with House Speaker Mike Johnson refusing to seat Adelita Grijalva because she'll be the, 218th signature on that Epstein Files petition to force a floor vote. But they can apply that as well, potentially after 2026, to say, well, this comes from a state where they have a lot of illegal voters. So we are not going to seat this congressman or woman.
Yeah. And then right now they're just trying to delay her swearing in. But, they could very well, if I wrote a long article for Mother Jones about 10 ways that Trump is attacking fair elections. And the last point was this very point, that Trump could pressure Mike Johnson not to seat Democratic members of the House if the House is up for grabs. And especially if it's a place like California, where they've already attacked the voting process, where the results could take longer to count, they could absolutely say the election was fraudulent. We don't want to seat you. We're going to draw this out. Now, I don't think that would ultimately work, because there'd be no basis for them to ultimately claim this, but it doesn't mean they can't try.
Right.
And it doesn't mean they can't try to make the system as chaotic as possible. Mm-hmm. And so I absolutely think that if all else fails, failing to seat people contesting the results will be their last deck of cards they'll try to play.
And folks can read about that in, I believe that's your cover story over at Mother Jones for the September-October issue. I will link to it when we post today's show at bradblog.com. That headline, Project 2026, Trump's plan to rig the next election. So go over there and terrify yourself. In the meantime, I'm just going to throw in a vote here. None of this is going to work. We are not going to stand for it. But thank God we've got people like Ari Berman calling it out, shining a light on this, so we can figure out how to fight the hell back against it. Ari Berman is the national voting rights correspondent at Mother Jones. His latest book is Minority Rule, the Right-Wing Attack on the Will of the People and the Fight to Resist It. You can find his work as ever at motherjones.com and, of course, on the blue skies at Ari Berman. Hey, thanks, Ari. Really appreciate you joining us. Let's not make it another 3 or 4 years until we talk again.
For sure, Brad. Thanks for having me. I know there'll be a lot to discuss in the coming months.
Unfortunately, there will be. Thank you, brother.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okie dokie then.
Well, okay. So real quick, I know we're short on time, but what are potential solutions to these very scary scenarios like congressional Republicans refusing to seat the next Congress and stuff?
You asked me that when I got a minute left on the clock. Okay, I'll tell you really quickly. Don't give in. Don't be frightened. Don't let them get away with this crap. Yeah, sure, they can deploy troops to the polling place or something. Don't be cowed by that crap. I don't believe Americans will be. Now, you know, when voter suppression happens, it's horrible because it takes away rights from people. But to steal an entire election, you have to take away the rights from, you know, a whole lot of people. Yes, it has happened in this country before. We can go back to 2000 and look how that played out. But all the things that they're trying to do, yes, they're going to try to do them. Yes, we are going to have to fight for our democracy. Yes, we are going to have to not be cowed by their tactics and fight like hell. But hey, no one said democracy was going to be easy.
This is true. So spread the word, share the knowledge, get out and vote, help other people vote.
And fight like hell.
For democracy.
For democracy, for your vote, for everyone else's vote. It ain't going to be easy, but
that's the work.
Anyway, thanks. Good question.
Thank you.
Anyway, we'll take an hour or two to answer it next time. But my thanks again to Ari Berman and to our producer, Desi Doyen, and all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. And please, while you're there, do consider hitting a donate button. You guys are the only ones who help us stay on your public airwaves. You can also go straight to bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, especially Blue Sky, I am the Brad Blog. See you there until we see you here next time. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener-supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.